Welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, the Brian Stewart Finlay of Political Podcast. Well, here we are, new season four, episode one. We took a month off, and one or two things happened in that time. New head of state, new head of government. But apart from that, it was obviously quite quiet. Deborah, who's, I should introduce myself for people that maybe not seen the first three seasons. I'm your host, David McClement, transmitting from the Blantyre Free State. And normally I would be accompanied by my good friend Deborah, but she's having some tech issues. And she, her last message was she was too angry at her iPad to record, even if she could get it to work. So, but we just two of us this week for a wee change. But I'm sure able to pick up the slack is our man in Dundee, the only monolingual member of the Beaton Clan, Mr. Conor Beaton. Conor, welcome back.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me. Big day, fourth season.
Season four, where does the time go?
I feel like every TV show I've ever watched, fourth season is always like peak quality. It's got, you know, it's found its stride. It's not quite dropped off yet.
You're saying next season is when it's really got to go downhill?
Yeah.
We're getting off to a bad start because it's not just Deborah missing. After having a month of perfectly good health, a couple of days ago I get hit with a really bad cold. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I'm sipping water every 2 minutes in order to not turn into a wee croaky voice in your ear. So hopefully my voice lasts out for the whole pod, otherwise Connor's really going to have to do some heavy lifting.
That's just how sickened you are by the, you know, the new king. It's actually physically draining your life force.
It just sounds weird. So we'll get straight into it. So obviously the first thing, Queen Elizabeth II died on the 8th of September. It was announced at 6:30 in the evening, although I think by then everybody realised what had happened, but the media decided not to share it with us. So the UK entered a period of national mourning that lasted 10 days. Queen Lane State and Westminster Hall, during which time an estimated 250,000 people queued to pay their respects. It was then the state funeral held at Westminster Abbey, followed by a committal service at George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. And then she was interred with King George VI's Memorial Chapel. And it was a public holiday in the UK and several Commonwealth figures. Obviously, we're both Republicans, Connor, so this is a really kind of weird, moment, but you know, it was kind of hard to deny the history of it, even when you just said there about it. Just the idea of a king seems so bizarre because, you know, the Queen's been there so long, 70 years. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I wasn't moved by the occasion. I have heard a lot of people saying, you know, you've got to appreciate it. It's a big, not necessarily a sad moment for a lot of people, but it's something that's been there all their lives and it's gone, and you have to appreciate that that can be a bit rattling. I don't think I feel that. I don't share that sentiment. Probably the less I say, the better, actually. But certainly, yeah, not going along with the national mourning. And I think it was actually a bit dispiriting to see how many people did go along with the idea that the whole country had to go and pause for 10 days out of respect. And you saw strikes getting called off, protests getting called off. I think that was, you know, frankly, it's a bit disrespectful to the millions of people who are struggling in poverty this winter to say that, you know, their issues are less important than an old 96-year-old woman dying of old age.
Well, I mean, as Lindsay Hoyle said, it was the most important event the world will ever see. I mean, I couldn't believe when he said that. I mean, it was like, I can't even get inside somebody's head that would genuinely think that. Even if he'd said one of the biggest events or one of the biggest events of the last century, you know, some kind of qualifier, but just this childish, it's the biggest thing ever.
Yeah.
I think even like, you know, people, pro-monarchy people felt a bit cringe at that. It was,
I don't know, man, because some of the monarchists in this country, like, they're so much further divorced from reality than I think I ever realised before this whole episode. And I mean, I went to the proclamation of Charles in Edinburgh, and I got into a little bit of trouble for heckling, actually. But some of the people around us, you know, there was a guy who was kept shouting that he wanted absolute monarchy. He wanted Charles to run everything. And when we kind of talked to him a little bit, he was saying to us if we didn't like it, we should go to France. I kind of felt like being transported directly into the 18th century.
Well, we can't go to France anymore. What happened with you for Brexit?
I've still got a German passport. I can.
Oh, I forgot about that. Just need to learn the language then, Connor, and you'll be able to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be laughing.
But it was a very strange period because, I think the sort of the cheating that a lot. I thought it was like with this kind of enforced. Mm-hmm. You know, enforced grief. Like, I think it made it very difficult for Republicans. I suppose that's probably the point, but It seemed to me it was impossible to be respectful without selling out your principles as a Republican. And I think some people just thought, well, why bother trying to be respectful?
Yeah.
And I can kind of understand that. You know, Patrick Harvey, I heard him getting a lot of criticism for his speech when King Charles came to the Scottish Parliament, which made me go and dig it out. And I mean, I just felt as if, well, if that's objectionable, then just there is, it may as well give up any pretense that being a Republican is allowed. You know, like, there's just a line that I wrote down here. The experience of loss is universal. It comes to all in our lives. It's a reminder that the reality of human life is not rooted in status or title, but in the connections we make. But that, apparently that wasn't respectful enough. Well, you might as well have just fucking told Charlie to fuck off then, because The criticism would come in anyway. Why should we make an effort to be respectful or meet them halfway when...
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly how I feel, because I don't think anyone would have... You know, there's all this kind of narrative. You can't criticise, you know, Charles or the royals as an institution generally, because they're grieving, they're going through loss, and that's something that, you know, everyone can relate to. And you know, they need that, you know, they deserve their space and their privacy, which is true. But if that would be the case, if they were actually grieving in private, which they weren't, they were having firstly an enforced period of national mourning. Secondly, they were having a royal tour whereby Charles was going to Scotland, Wales, Ireland, all these parts of the UK, again as an explicitly unionist thing, talking about keeping the country together. And I thought it was really interesting how brazenly the BBC was putting that together, putting that across, that the whole time she was dying, oh, she's dying in Scotland, and she loved Scotland. And they kept referring to her comments during the referendum campaign, where she had said that she'd hoped people would think very carefully, which was really interesting, because I remember at the time that happened that they had all the journalists saying palace sources deny that she said any such thing, whereas now in retrospect it's just kind of tacitly confirmed she did say that and she did mean that. And now it's just taken as a thing that was a totally okay thing for the unelected monarch to say during the referendum campaign. But yeah, we just had this whole kind of parade, song and dance shoved down our throats, and then it was disrespectful to say anything against it. And I think people still think it's disrespectful. You know, there's no pleasing these people. And if we'd waited, you know, nobody would have paid attention, because nobody gives us a spotlight any other time of the year.
Yeah, and my main thought when they said that was, it's not us that we're not in favour of this system where the only time you change the head of state is in the wake of somebody dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, well, when can we protest it then? If it's the most appropriate time is to do it when there's a change. And it's not our fault that you choose a system that, you know, incorporates death as the only, well, I suppose that you can abdicate, but...
Yeah, it's very macabre, know, isn't it?
Yeah, because it mixes it all up, because it's all tied up with, you know... It was difficult to tell what events were supposedly about the funeral and the death, and which ones were about, you know, introducing the new king and solidifying his, you know, power base. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was clearly intentional. They sort of use the death to sort of shield him from that.
Yeah, so like Prince Andrew, as an example, He was kind of front and center for so much of this kind of whole period. You know, firstly, the televised thing of him arriving at Balmoral when the Queen was actually already dead at that point, but before they announced it. And then his kind of role in all the, you know, processions and kind of funeral related things, where he is someone who has just paid £12 million, I think it was, in order to avoid having to defend in court allegations of sexual abuse, because he's a admitted friend of a paedophile and sexual abuser in the shape of Jeffrey Epstein. That was something, again, that apparently it was bad to criticise at the time because he was a grieving family member. But at the same time, it's kind of completed his rehabilitation because he had that role and the media accepted it and didn't say a word against it. He could probably do that again at some other royal event and get away with it now because there's precedent there. You know, he was already at this thing, why can't he be at another thing, etc. So I don't know. I think it's quite dangerous to accept the line that we can just wait for a better time, because some of these things are, you know, irreversible. You can't undo the impact of normalizing Andrew's public appearances.
Yeah, I mean, he was somebody who, previous to the Queen dying, had been sort of banished from public life. You know, he'd get away with whatever illegal activities he may have been involved with, but, you know, he was gone as a royal, but suddenly this opportunity arose and he's been pushed front and centre. And now, I can't remember the technical thing, but Charles has named him as one of the sort of lieutenants that can stand in for him. So he's back as a kind of front and centre working royal.
I think it's a default. I don't think he needed to actively appoint him. I think it's a default kind of role. But again, that shows how rotten the whole institution is, where you just get these kind of privileges handed to you by virtue of birth.
Are you sure that I interpreted it that he'd been picked? Maybe I'm wrong.
I could be wrong, if that's what it said.
But it's worked as well, because the opinion polls of Charles as the future king of Holland, roughly between 30% and 40% for decades, and now all of a sudden they're over 60%. This little propaganda works.
Yeah, and I suppose we'll have to see whether that is sustained. I mean, it's actually not been coronated yet. His coronation is going to be next summer, and I think that's probably where all Republicans are looking now, is how do we build a movement, a campaign? You know, we couldn't have predicted when the Queen would die. We couldn't have, you know, planned for that, but we know that there's going to be a coronation next year, probably next summer, so they can take advantage of, you know, outdoor street events and stuff like that. And that'll be what everyone is working towards now, trying to make sure that that is taken as we're going to drag his reputation through the mud, and we're going to build support for independence. Support for a republic, but support for independence as well, actually.
Yeah. Did you see any of the stuff about Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby?
Oh, the Q jumpers.
Yeah, that was the most ludicrous thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, who cares? I don't care if they jump the queue. I think it's actually much less embarrassing to jump that queue than to be standing in it for hours and hours, because that really makes me question so much about you as a person. Unless you're, you know, literally, like, actually, I think it's fine for someone like David Beckham to go stand in a queue for, you know, 24 hours or whatever, because he doesn't actually have anything useful to do, and he's so rich that I'm sure nothing is lost.
And he's been chasing that knighthood for about 10, 15 years, so, you know, he's going to jump in that opportunity.
Yeah.
People always
say he's going to literally put a sword in the Queen's hand and make her do it, make her limp corpse do it.
I mean, I don't understand why nobody ever remembers that about Beckham. His emails all get leaked, and it was loads of emails with a mourning saying how many bloody charity events they need to go to get him out. Like, it was the most, like, you couldn't have made it up. It's the sort of thing that you would imagine might go on behind closed doors, but it was so blatant. It was I'm wanting a knighthood. To his agent, what else do I need to do to get a knighthood now? What? How many charities do I need to go and support him?
Yeah, I think it would be remiss of me not to mention, you know, the arrests that there were across Britain, you know, in the wake of the proclamation, and particularly the couple of cases we had in Scotland. So we had a young woman who had a placard that said, "Fuck imperialism, abolish monarchy," and she lifted up in Edinburgh, and she was arrested, and she is actually facing a trial, which originally was going to take place on the 30th of September in Edinburgh, but has been postponed until, I think, the Friday, the 14th of October. And she's been charged with breach of the peace, which is, again, you know, people will be familiar with how that is used repeatedly for protests, football fans, whatever the police have an issue with. And there's also the guy who heckled Andrew as, you know, correctly saying, I think it was actually very measured. I can't remember what exactly he shouted, but something like, "Andrew, you're a dirty old man.
A disgusting old man," or something. Yeah.
And not only was he arrested for that, he was also assaulted by two royalists there who were trying to pull him out of the crowd and give him a bit of a kicking. And I was actually very pleased to see that those two guys assaulted him.
Yeah, that was only yesterday or the day before I saw that.
Which is ridiculous because they should have been arrested on the spot.
Yeah.
But yeah, these two protesters, and I know there was also, you know, one in London, not London, but in England, I think it was Oxford, who had shouted, "Who elected him?" After the king was proclaimed. It's a very, you know, legitimate question, and he was next. And so, yeah, it's troubling to see that not only were these people arrested, which they shouldn't have been, but also that some of these are proceeding to a prosecution, which is just ridiculous. And I hope that they're dropped, you know, they could still be dropped. But I'm certainly giving them all my support. I think it was really appalling. And I was there when Maria, the 22-year-old woman, was arrested in Edinburgh. And she was perfectly quiet. She lifted up a sign. Some people have an issue with swearing. I think, you know, some people actually need to catch up with the 21st century, which is, I don't think "fuck" is the most offensive word anymore. But even still, it wasn't like the police came up and asked her to get rid of it. The police went up and just nicked her right away. She wasn't shouting, she wasn't yelling, she wasn't causing a scene.
I do wonder if that was if it was that word that that gave them the pretext. But we also saw, I think, down in England, somebody arrested for having a blank bit of paper because they may write something objectionable, which is, you know, absolutely ludicrous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know where the other one was, but again, it was somebody with a blank piece of paper and the police just kind of harassed her.
Mm-hmm.
And like, kept following her about all the time. Like, I'm trying to go home.
That was because there was a solidarity demonstration in Edinburgh where there were people holding blank pieces of paper and a blank banner as well. And I know some of the people who were involved in that. It was really good to kind of highlight the absurdity of this whole situation. And subsequent to that, one of the people taking part was followed considerable distance by police officers who they challenged. It was good. I'm sure you've seen the video that's going around online.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just completely out of control. I feel really bad. Like Maria, who's up in court soon, is a student from Mexico, and what kind of, and she put out a fantastic statement, which you really have to see. She says, "I condemned the centuries of colonial injustice, genocide, and unlawful extraction that have been and continue to be carried out in the name of the British Crown." And I think what kind of message is it sending that, you know, you can come to the UK, you can come to Scotland as a student with that kind of understanding of how the world is structured, and for daring to challenge it, you get arrested and dragged through court, having your court date changed as well at short notice and things like that. It's just a total stress. And I wish actually the Scottish government was speaking out on this. The SNP and the Greens should be really pushing the fact that if the law says you can arrest someone for expressing republicanism, then the law probably has to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Full support to her for that. It's ludicrous that it was really just that it sort of took the facade away from what the state really can be at times, is just willing to crush anybody in any dissent. You know, in support of this sort of antiquated institution. But
100%.
I've just got to say though, like, about the Holly Phillips Schofield and Holly Willoughby thing, what I really found hilarious about that was the people, the, you know, pro-Monica people were so furious about that. I think still trying to get them sacked for ITV. Is that what was upsetting them is that somebody was getting special privileges. Like, you do not understand what monarchy is. And it's like, so why are you upset about them skipping my queue, but you're fine with somebody receiving millions and millions of public money, despite the fact that they've got unimaginable wealth, and being exempt from, you know, income tax law, being exempt from all kinds of other laws, don't even need to have a passport. You know, it's why does that not upset you?
But it's the perfect, like,
things to be fair and equal.
It's the perfect, like, microcosm of how distorted. You know, the British, it's the British national psyche, if there is such a thing, where like paying off accusers of your paedophile son is like somewhere ranked below skipping a queue, like any queue, as an offence. It's sort of funny because, like, the Holly Willoughby Phillips Schofield, like, statement they put afterwards wasn't like, we would never have skipped this queue. It was also like, we would never skip a queue at all. Defending their honour.
I always remember mom had a friend who had the most brass neck or the brassest neck ever, in terms of they would unashamedly walk to the front of a taxi rank and just walk and jump in the taxi, or walk to the front of a queue at, say, like a nightclub or things like that, and just bluff their way in. Mm-hmm. And
it's obviously, like, not a nice thing to do. It's also not a crime. It's not like there's a law here that says you can't do that. I'm not advocating this, to be clear. It sounds like I'm advocating.
You're advocating chaos.
Just to be very clear,
a dangerous anarchist. And
I would never skip a queue. I just want to put it out there.
Then why are you not more upset?
Honestly, I couldn't care less about what order people are seeing a dead body in, or not even seeing a dead body, seeing a coffin that probably had sandbags in it.
I had a friend that went to see the coffin in Edinburgh, and he's a socialist, he's a Republican, but if you know him, it didn't surprise you, because he just does things like this, like, for a laugh. So he waited 7 hours and then wound up on, like, Italian TV and getting interviewed by CNN or something like that. He was just like, hey, I just thought it was very historical and be nice to see. Now he's forever down as some kind of monarchist.
I got interviewed by a couple of international journalists at the Proclamation in Edinburgh, including a French, I think it was a French freelance reporter who put out some tweets in which he said my name was Colner, C-O-L-L-N-E-R, and that Alan Armstrong, one of my comrades in the Republican Socialist Platform, was my dad, which I don't know where they got this from. It's quite entertaining. That's the historical record now, tainted for life.
Call them. Great.
Yeah.
But he said there was people absolutely drunk in the queue and things like that. Like, you know, it seemed like people were just there for a day out. His reduction reminded me of when you see people going to an on walk, you know, and they're already steaming and,
you know, it's like public drinking in the queue. Are you allowed to? Was there like a waiver on public drinking laws?
If you toasted the Queen with every sip, maybe that's how it worked.
Yeah.
So obviously we spoke a bit about Charles being the new king. So he's now the new head of state, King Charles III. Seemed to be an expectation that he'd choose a different regnal name from his given name because of the negative connotations of the previous King Charles, but he went with that. I'm sure I remember years ago he said that he was going to choose Edward. He's also now the oldest person ever to ascend the British throne. So do you think his reign will go any better than the first two Charleses, one of which ended in decapitation, and the other one, well, technically it was under his brother's reign, but quickly led to a civil war?
I hope we get more of the same. But I mean, yes, it's perfect. You know, like, Charles is the perfect name for a king at a time of total crisis in the British establishment writ large. So I think it's fitting. And I think it's really funny that the first kind of political expression of Charles being the new king is in the Scottish Parliament just today, which is the 4th of October for our listeners. The news that the rent freeze bill going through the Scottish Parliament had to be vetted by him first. And the only reason we know that is because they very recently changed the rules so that when the monarch vets a law, they have to say so. And so the very first thing that we're finding out about Charles and his role in our kind of constitutional framework is that they checked with him if he was okay with a rent freeze, considering that he has tenants of his own.
Yeah, which is interesting that I think was it Edinburgh City Council when they were discussing something to do with rent? The councillors that were housing association tenants had to recuse themselves from the debate.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see that Edinburgh City Councils get a higher standard for that than the head of state.
Because a tenant, of course, has got a biased opinion on questions of rent, but, you know, a wealthy landlord with a privileged position in our constitution would be neutral and frankly would make the God intended divine correct decision.
Yeah, there was, I think we spoke about it a couple of seasons ago in the pod about the Queen sort of being able to vet all these laws, because that was one of the things that monarchists always like to say. So, you know, it's a constitutional monarchy, and they don't have any real power. The Queen, in her 70 years on the throne, never vetoed any law. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, because by the time they get to that stage, she's already influenced it, you know.
Yep.
She was getting input at the very in the ground floor of a law to take out any bits that she didn't like or would affect her interest.
Yeah, I think the problem is a lot of people are easily convinced that the monarchy doesn't have any real power or that its role in the constitution is kind of token. But that's also because, you know, that's how it's meant to work at a time of like social peace or whatever you want to call it. It's meant to be as invisible as possible. And it's only really at a time of crisis that you see any of these things deployed. So obviously the example a lot of Republicans use is Australia, the Gough Whitlam government in the 1970s, where the Prime Minister was removed from power and his opponent was invited to form a government by the Governor General for Australia, who is effectively the monarch's personal representative in Australia. And there was very recently some research done with the letters that were exchanged between, you know, Buckingham Palace and the Governor General about all the kind of the machinations that were going on behind the scenes. But there's another really good example, I thought, this week again, news that Bermuda wanted to pass legislation legalizing cannabis for recreational use. And it's been halted by the UK government on the basis that they don't think it's compatible with, you know, Bermuda's international treaty obligations and stuff like that. But again, I think it's a really good example that at the best of times, you know, these powers and these options that are available are kind of invisible and they're not used. But then suddenly they come out of nowhere when they're needed. And we just don't think about that. And it really poses a question for me about independence, because I'd rather not have an independent Scotland where we still have a process whereby, for example, legislation is vetted by the British monarchy, or where legislation can be vetoed by the British monarchy, even if it's just on the advice of the British government. And, you know, even if we think about during Brexit, the prorogation crisis, when Boris Johnson got the Queen to dissolve Parliament so that he would avoid being held to account, that was reversed because of the Supreme Court. But I'd rather not have to rely on the Supreme Court to make sure that, you know, what we consider to be constitutional norms are always you know, followed, because, you know, what, why are we relying always on convention and kind of guidelines rather than having, as the vast majority of countries in the world do, a written constitution that says who actually has the power to do these things? And I would certainly not want it to be, you know, Charles or some random person who just happened to be in the line of succession.
Yeah, and it's the kind of, I always think it's like Schrodinger's monarch. They don't have any real power. They're just a figurehead, but at the same time, they protect us from tyranny because they can remove a, corrupt or fascist government, which
not doing well in that,
not seen that so far. You know, what brings us on nicely to the new government. You know, Liz Truss was confirmed as a new leader of the Tory party and prime minister just 2 days before the Queen died. She announced one of her first priorities was to lift the cap in bankers' bonuses. Our new chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, announced a mini budget, which included slashing taxes for top earners. This was so poorly received by financial markets that it was blamed for a rapid fall in the value of the pound, and prompted a response from the Bank of England that cost around £65 billion, and has led to an opinion poll that shows the Labour Party now have a 33-point lead. It went south very quickly for Liz Truss.
Yeah, I mean, they said, I think the point's been made by a lot of people, but they're really scraping the barrel now for Tory prime ministers. And it's hard to see how they get any lower than this. But yeah, I thought it was really funny. Obviously, she's taking the reins just before the Queen dies, and then she's got the entire spotlight of the international media and all these world leaders there. And it was all well summed up by that Australian news presenter live broadcasting her arriving at the funeral and saying, not sure who this is, maybe a minor royal or some local dignitary. Yeah, and this whole government's been a shambles from the start, and I think the U-turns have been really funny. They've actually got an even funnier dimension in Scotland, because you've got the Scottish Tory Party flip-flopping, where you have Douglas Ross begging the Scottish government to also cut tax for the richest people, because they did it in London, and then immediately turn around when there's a U-turn and say, actually, I think it's really good that they've changed their mind on this.
Yeah, I saw that.
And there's also the suggestions from people like, for example, Rory Dunlop, who's the head of the advocates profession in Scotland, suggesting that he would move just across the border into England in order to save money on tax. I actually think the Scottish government should have taken a much stronger line in response to that, because they kind of prevaricated. There was a moment where I think it was unclear whether the Scottish government would follow suit with some sort of tax cuts, because they said, you know, this is totally you know, misguided, blah 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 blah, but they didn't actually rule out cutting tax in Scotland. They kind of, I felt like they were kind of leaving the door open for saying, well, we might not do the same thing, but we might tinker a little bit depending on how this all pans out. Of course, we'll never find out how that would have happened, because it's been pulled back. But I think they should have been a lot firmer, and they should have said, like, for example, okay, if you're a lawyer and you practice in Scotland, then you have to be resident in Scotland. You know, a lot of countries have rules like that. For example, Ireland, if you want to be a practicing solicitor or a practicing barrister in Ireland, you actually have to have a residence in Ireland. And a lot of lawyers in Britain found this out, because after Brexit, tons of them registered to become lawyers in Ireland so that they could maintain their rights to appear in European Union courts. Thousands of them did this, and then turned out they couldn't actually get any benefit of this, because they also needed to get a practicing certificate. And in order to do that, they had to prove they actually lived in Ireland. And so they all came off again. Why do we do that in Scotland? You know, if you're a high paid lawyer, then you don't have the option of going across the border for a more preferential tax regime. You know, if you want to be practicing in the Scottish courts, then you've got to live in Scotland. Sorry. And we should have done the same thing for, you know, all the professions, all the kind of people who would be inclined to do that. Even if it was like, you know, if you've got to live in London or something for work, that's fine. But your tax residence is going to be in Scotland, or, you know, you don't get all the privileges that come with being a Scottish professional.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be against that in principle. But at the same time, I'm always sceptical about all these people that announced they're going to emigrate because they suddenly need to pay an extra penny in the pound and tax. You know, I'm sure somebody's done it at some stage, but the numbers are so tiny.
Yeah, but think like I think it was, originally it was assessed if you were earning £1 million or more, then under Kwasi Kwarteng's budget, you would have saved something like £50,000 a year in tax. You know, that's probably more than both of our salaries put together. I can easily imagine someone who lives in Edinburgh can move to Berwick. You're talking about less than an hour on the train to get in. It's not actually the biggest possible upheaval. Already a lot of people, you know, do live and work across the border. I went to Berwick at Pontypridd for the first time a few years ago as a wee holiday, and I was amazed, you know, how many people live there, work in Scotland and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, people that live close to the border, but £55,000, I think, is viewed very differently if you're a millionaire than the likes of us. You know, the hassle of moving house and things like that, even for £55,000, if you're earning millions.
But you're not necessarily even moving house. You know, you could have a spanky house in Edinburgh, but then you rent a flat across the border. You live there full time. You say you live there, and you get the benefit of it. And you know, £50,000, maybe not a big deal, but in 5 years, you've got £250,000.
Maybe. I just don't think the numbers of people that would go to that for tax reasons are anywhere near as high. There's always this scaremongering whenever the idea of tax going up slightly, that suddenly there'll be this mass brain drain and exodus.
I do agree with you. I do think you're right that it's over exaggerated for specific purposes, but that doesn't mean I don't think the government should take a hard line and clamp down on it. Another example would be, of course, landlords. And we've just had the rent freeze announcement, and now all the landlords are threatening to pull out of the sector and all this other stuff, which is kind of also a weirdly empty threat, because it's like they're not taking their houses with them. It's not like it's going to change the number of.
Well, that's it. If they sold them, that would surely help first time buyers and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, it's like sometimes, you know, raising a tax is not always about bringing in money. Maybe a lot of time it's about changing behaviours around whatever it is you're trying to tax.
Yep.
So I don't think that's the threat that they seem to think it was. Although we'd sell off this stock and, you know, reduce the house prices that, you know, people might actually be able to, you know, buy something.
But that's the thing, of course. Nobody wants to see house prices come down. I mean, people with a stake in it, I think, even though it inarguably has to happen. And I thought it was really interesting, actually, some of the responses to, the fallout from the mini budget. The market's kind of going mad, and the pound crashing in value, and the interest rates going up, and you know, the mortgage offers, you know, shrinking and becoming less favourable to first-time buyers, is some of the Labour MPs have been jumping on, saying, you know, oh, this government's so irresponsible, blah blah blah. I've got to keep the markets calm and everything. And I think very few people have made the point, which I think is legitimate, that we can't frame all of our government decision making on what the markets want and say is good. And actually, it's kind of a problem that we've got so many people invested in the state of the markets, because frankly, a radical left-wing government is going to make the markets unhappy too. My issue is not really so much that there's market upheaval, it's that it's market upheaval in the interests of making rich people richer, rather than market upheaval because they're panicking that, you know, house prices are going to come crashing down to affordable levels in this country.
What do you think was behind this? Like, this new, you know, trust government, are they just incompetent? You know, like, surely they must have thought this would happen, or was, you know, I have heard people alleging that they basically know that they're at the end of this kind of cycle of Tory power, and that they're basically just trying to fill other pals' pockets as they rush to the door. Possibly hand over a poison chalice to Labour, who will become massively unpopular and lose after one term, after fixing things.
I've heard that theory. I think actually, you know, I found that persuasive, but I think the fact that they've decided to make a U-turn is the mark against that one, because if they were doing this purely to fill their pockets and then go why would they back down? They should have just held to their guns because, you know, they've got this majority. I think there's a couple of things in play. I think partly it is maybe incompetence. I don't think it's economic incompetence. I think they know very well what the effect of what they're proposing would be. Maybe they underestimated the degree to which the markets would react to it. But I think also maybe they just overestimated how much political capital they actually had. Truss came in as a prime minister who won over a majority of Tory party members, but won over a relatively few, relatively small number of MPs. She was actually not even the most popular kind of choice among Tory party members. It's just that when she was put in a one-to-one with Rishi Sunak, she was seen as, you know, the more continuity candidate, which she's actually turned out not to be at all, because her policies have been completely divergent from Boris's. I think this just screams of the Tory party has been through so many different crises, and they've had like this cumulative effect, and that the new government doesn't actually realise the position that it's in, which is it has less political capital and less space to manoeuvre than the government that came before, which in turn had less than the government which came before that. And it could well be that soon we have Keir Starmer as Prime Minister, but I'm not actually particularly any more enthusiastic about that. I don't know how different that might be. It might just feel like we're going back to the David Cameron years rather than some of the stuff that came after that.
Do you believe that opinion poll that put them 33 points ahead? I mean,
I think I would believe that it's an accurate snapshot of how people maybe felt at the time. I don't think that means it's what would happen in a general election.
It seems like even my wildest dreams have never thought the Tories dropping that low in an opinion poll. Mm-hmm. You know, I think some of them were, you know, translating it to, you know, they were down to double figures in terms of seats.
I saw the suggestion that the SNP would be the official opposition at Westminster, which no, I don't that, even know what would happen. I don't even know if that would be possible. Like, can you refuse to form the official opposition? I don't know, because there is all these like privileges afforded to the, you know, main opposition party.
Well, you get extra money and things like that, don't you?
Because like going back to when the Queen died, and if you were watching BBC Parliament, you saw the moment where there was all kind of hushed voices and weird faces because someone had run in with some notes handed to Liz Truss and Keir Starmer, informing them of the situation. What a bizarre thing if it had just been like, you know, Ian Blackford sitting across Liz Truss, both getting this news and having to carry on with BMQs. BMQs, imagine Ian Blackford just gets to grill Truss for an hour. Or not Truss, Starmer.
And only talking about Scottish stuff.
Yeah.
And be like a whole news, like Scottish questions dominate the important thing.
That's funny, it'll be more Scottish focus from having a Scottish opposition leader than from having a Scottish PM in the shape of Gordon Brown.
I was laughing when I saw that the Doris was now calling for a general election. That's how bad it's got.
Yeah, this is, you get some weird, you know, like Michael Gove standing up for progressive taxation and things like that. It's all kinds of bizarre.
Yeah, so that, I mean, how right wing have we got that Michael Gove is attacked a government from the left? I mean, and that's the thing, you know, if there's a general election, it almost certainly Labour will win it. And it's because of how, you know, extreme and how bad the Tories have got. But you know, everybody around Keir Starmer will be completely convinced it was their own genius and the fact that and take this as a complete validation of their hideous left-bashing moves that they've been making. Which is, you know, what always pops into my head whenever you hear people saying, yeah, I know the issue's been labelled, but you need to get the Tories out. I just think, how can you really reward, you know, the Labour Party for the things they've done? Mm-hmm. And you might say, oh, well, I'd be holding my nose, but the vote, they'll not see that. They'll see a vote and just interpret it the way they want.
Yeah, I mean, like the last time the Labour Party was polling so well, like in the run-up to 1997, there was times when the Labour Party was polling over 50%. And you did have people on the left then as well, saying, oh, you know, Labour have to play this centrist kind of careful card now, but once they get in, you know, they'll have the freedom to do all this kind of radical stuff and nobody to stop them, which is putting a lot of trust in the natural instincts of Labour MPs. And I think it's very much the same thing with this. Even, you know, the question of proportional representation, a very minor constitutional reform when we're looking at how messed up the entire British political system is. And it's something that was passed with, you know, flying colours at the Labour Party conference recently, because finally some of the trade unions have got behind it. But Starmer saying, you know, he'll exercise a personal veto and make sure that that doesn't work its way into any Labour Party manifesto. I don't think that is a bluff for the media. I think he genuinely is quite conservative on that and obviously aspires to run a majority government. You certainly see how hostile he is to, example, sharing power with the SNP. And I think you can see very clearly in that how he feels a Labour government should rule, which is by itself. I think I would accept that a Starmer-led government would probably be in many ways more stable than what we've got at the minute, but I don't think, I don't have high hopes for it.
No, I mean, what at best, I think what we get is, it wouldn't get worse. Politics wouldn't get more right-wing, but I don't think it would really move much. I think it would stay much as it is. And then in 5 years' time, with the Tories back, try to drag us even further right again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Labour governments in the UK just seem to be best a time to catch your breath. They're not a time of progress.
I think it's often been described as like a release valve for, you know, British capitalism in crisis. You know, get Labour in for a couple of years, cool things down, and then we can go back to the way it was. And I mean, people had that expectation with, you know, Trump in the States, that once he was out of power and, you know, a Democrat president could investigate, you know, all his wrongdoing and kind of, you know, crack down fully on Trumpism, that it would kind of evaporate. You know, he's been banned from social media and he'll be gone. And it actually looks like he is as popular now as he was years ago, if not even maybe slightly more popular. And I think that has a question for actually, if there was a Labour government in this country, which I mean the UK, how does it actually avoid just an equally right-wing Tory government getting back in after? And that's actually one of the reasons I think constitutional change is actually a really important political question at the minute, is because the constitutional changes are irreversible in a way that tinkering with, you know, the welfare state or pretending to launch a public energy company would be.
Yeah, I mean, changing to a more proportional voting system would be, I don't know the right word for it, not quite revolutionary, but I think it would be a huge step in the right direction for the UK. Like, the problem with the only people that can do it are the Labour Party or the Tory Party. Both of them are the biggest losers of making that change. So I don't see it ever happening. I can only ever see it happening under a, you know, a Corbyn-like Labour Party, and even then, there'd be huge opposition within the party, and they just get too much to lose.
One thing I think has gone really unremarked upon in the rest of the UK is that Wales, the Senedd, is currently reforming its voting system, and it's been a little bit contentious. There's a lot of people who are not quite happy with the way that it's going ahead. It's not clear that that will actually have any impact. But they're moving to, again, breaking new ground in UK electoral systems. They're going for a kind of a party list system like we have for like the regions, but they're going to just have that. They're not going to have any first past the post constituencies. So you're going to have purely a regional vote. And it's quite interesting. And I don't know why actually we're not having more of a discussion about electoral reform in Scotland with the Scottish Parliament, because I think the constituency and regional ballot thing is frankly a little bit confusing to people, and I hate this narrative you get, actually quite common in the independence movement, where regional list MSPs aren't actually properly elected.
I find that infuriating. Yeah. It absolutely makes my blood boil when I hear people would say that.
And so I don't think this two-tier system is really good, so I'm surprised that they're again kind of pushing ahead in Wales, and it doesn't seem to be really on the register, like the on the agenda in Scotland. We just get these little wee tweaks, like really good things about, you know, the voting franchise, but not really the system writ large.
I would, yeah, I hadn't heard that about the Welsh Parliament making that change, but I would definitely prefer that to the current Scottish Parliament system.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because some people on the left in Wales are actually really opposed to it on the basis that, you know, with a party list, the party gets to decide the order of which people appear on this. So you maybe get fewer kind of maverick MSPs. You know, oftentimes you could have a constituency MSP somewhere who is, as an individual, really popular. So it's like thinking in Scotland, some examples would be like Dennis Canavan, who is an independent MSP, or John McCallion, you know, that's the earlier kind of half of the Scottish Parliament. But
they were very much the exceptions, though.
Like, yeah, I think
for every individual like that, there is far more examples of sitting MPs leaving the party, standing and getting nothing, like nowhere near losing their deposit. And at the end of the day, the part, because of that, outside of those very, very extreme examples you stated, the party still has the power because the individual will not get elected if they're not running that party ticket. So it is, I've heard that argument, but it's no one that, that holds much water for me.
I think that's true. It's exclusively been raised in the content in the concept of, you know, Wales. What would it be good to have a system whereby you're only ever electing party loyalists, or would it be good to have a system whereby, you know, you can vote in a maverick for being a maverick? I will say I agree that that's not how the system normally works, and I'd actually say the solution to that. I actually kind of hate when you get these maverick MSPs and stuff like that sometimes a little bit because, you know. Sometimes you wonder why certain politicians belong to certain parties in the first place. You know, if like you're, sometimes there's left-wing MSPs or MPs or members of whatever parliament who are closer together politically than they are with the leadership of their own respective parties, and you wonder why are you there in the first place? It's almost like I don't like how it kind of gives credibility sometimes.
Yeah, you know. I also remember when the Scottish Parliament first started, the first couple of terms when Labour, you know, dominated the constituencies, and you'd hear Labour Party supporters always going about looking down their nose at the list MSPs, this being sort of, you know, second class members of the Parliament. And it was almost seamless when, in 2015, when SNP took all the constituencies. I heard SNP supporters suddenly parroting the exact same things that that I've been arguing with Labour supporters about before that. And it seems to be, for some people, your view of first past the post changes depending on if you hold the seats.
Yeah, which is funnily enough how, you know, Westminster political parties treat it as well. It's a bad thing until it works in your favour, and then it's actually really good.
I do go and talk about vote systems. I like that though, so I'm quite easily diverted that way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Liz Truss is going to last in the general election? I was 100% saying, of course, it's far too close, but the last kind of week is kind of shaking my confidence.
I don't know, man. It's just, you know, because I also feel like, how could they possibly get rid of her so soon without becoming a laughing stock? You know, it's almost better to have, you're almost better to stick with a bad leader than to get rid of them too quickly. I don't know. I don't even know when there's going to be a general election.
I think the latest it can be is January 2025. So 2 years, basically.
It'd be remarkable if this parliament, for all of the kind of crises that has engulfed it with, you know, Partygate and COVID and Boris Johnson and then Liz Truss and the mini budget and all this stuff, it would be so funny if this ended up being the first parliament in ages that actually lasted the full 5-year term.
Yeah, true. But I mean, if the opinion polls hold up, there's no way that the Tories will go to an election. Mm-hmm. We will be having an early New Year election in early 2025 because they'll cling on as long as they can to. I'll do as much damage
jobs.
Yeah, fill their pockets as much as they could.
Unless they all start panicking so much that they start resigning their seats to take up cushy, you know, consulting jobs and stuff like that, get out when the going's good.
I think we'll still get a big enough majority that
I don't even know what it is. Is it like 50 or something?
Something like that. I don't remember the detail off my head. I find as the older I get, the less details I remember. I can still remember that Tony Blair's first government had 173 majority and then 169 majority in the second one, but that kind of detail just passes me by.
Yeah. I mean, if it's 50 or so, that's 50 people whose lives we should be trying to make an absolute misery until they quit. It should be the main strategy.
Well, I saw some footage of the Tory conference and people were certainly trying their best.
And I actually really liked that there was no national moral panic about that in the same way that there was in Scotland with the Tory party hustings, where suddenly like every SNP MP and every Herald columnist and stuff had to go talking at length about how they were morons and idiots because people were shouting at Tories, and one person was heckling a BBC journalist. Which I thought was, and people were saying, we have to change the rules in any future referendum so people who would do something like that would never be allowed near it. I was quite glad that you didn't actually see any of that discourse around the Tory party conference, which actually I think is a little bit embarrassing for how the political discourse in Scotland is kind of poisoned by partly the referendum and partly all the kind of received wisdom that goes around it, like Scottish independence supporters are uniquely abusive and have to be reeled in.
But we saw the exact same sort of things deployed against Corbyn supporters as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tried and tested playbook that they've got for these things. Is there anything else about Liz Truss that you want to talk about before we move on? Any other?
I think I feel like I've talked about Liz Truss for long enough now.
I kind of worried that she might be a combination of the worst aspects of Boris and the worst aspects of Theresa May. And it's kind of starting to look a bit like that. I thought she actually, during the campaign, actually started to come across a wee bit more competent than I'd seen her before. But anyway, that's gone.
A lot of people around her kind of carefully managing it. And now the problem is she's in number 10 and there's no, the leash is off.
Yeah. They weren't always supporting the people. Okay, our final thing we're talking about this week is something a bit more positive. Senior Scottish footballer Xander Murray has become the first senior Scottish footballer to say that he's openly gay. That should be male footballer, actually. The Galifrey Deal Rovers player said he's been blown away by the reaction since made the announcement last week. It's still very rare for male professional footballers to say they're gay, and Murray says that he hopes he'll be a role model for younger players coming into Scottish football. Thoughts, Conor?
Well, I actually didn't know that this had happened until you told me about it before we came on. So I'd kind of missed that in the news. I'm not a huge football fan, which is probably why that happened. But I think that's really good news. That seems good. I mean, there's definitely a kind of a cultural issue still around, there's machismo and homophobia, and a lot of that ties in with how certain football fans behave. It's really nice actually to get a little bit of a challenge to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a long overdue. I mean, statistically, there must be obviously a lot more gay footballers that have no one to publicly out. I have heard that there is, I don't know necessarily in Scotland, but certainly in the UK, that there is gay footballers that are sort of out within their club and things like that, but then they don't want to be publicly out. I think a lot of Scottish football fans are more progressive on this issue than people give them credit for. And I think what we've needed is to move forward with this issue and combat homophobia is still there, as we needed somebody to actually come out. And, hats off to Xander Murray for that, because I think I've not heard about any negativity around it. People have been very positive. He said that he's been supported well, and hope this now makes it easier for other players to come out. And no disrespect to Xander, but players playing at a higher level with a bit more of a higher profile. And I feel it needs that in order to, you know, get beyond this and move the sport out away from the dark ages. We had there has been campaigns before in Scotland and UK, like the Rainbow Laces, and there's a lot of players behind the scenes were able to take part in that because they felt they would get targeted. And you know, it was sad to hear, but we need somebody to stick their head above the parapet to get a chance to support them.
There's, I think it's like sometimes people can be quite disdainful of it, and I don't, you know, even though I'm not a big fan of football myself, I don't really get where that comes from. And you can see it's a really important part of people's lives, big part of their social lives. You even saw that a big part of how they express themselves as well. You saw that after the Queen died and they called off the football games, and there was a lot of, I think, correct speculation that the biggest reason for that was not that it would be disrespectful to play sports, because actually there were games of cricket and rugby that were going ahead. It was specifically football because you've got there thousands of working class people who, you know, express themselves politically, socially. They didn't want to have anything embarrassing like chants in the stadiums or banners that wouldn't quite match the national narrative at the time. And I think that's a really powerful illustration of how important as a social force football is, especially when so much of our other kind of sections of civic society have been gutted. You know, we don't have as many people going to church, we don't have as many people in trade unions, but we certainly still fill football stadiums in Scotland. And so, yeah, it's really good to see social change overdue, but a very welcome move.
Yep. Well done, Xander Murray. Unfortunately, I think Galifrey his team did lose 4-3 to Celtic the other day, so be a luck there. I was quite happy with that.
Well, it's kind of like there was all these suggestions of you know, Scotland and Ukraine playing in the football. There should be expressions of support, but it doesn't go as far as to say we think you should win. You know, solidarity with Ukraine against the war, but we are going to try and batter you.
There was definitely people advocating that, but it was so obvious that they weren't the football fans that were saying, we should just withdraw and let them go through. And football fans were like, hey, we might be in favour, we might have a lot of sympathy for them, but when it comes to the actual match, you know, the gloves will be off during the game.
I saw at least one Scottish-Ukrainian person saying, with all due respect, Scotland needs this more.
Although I did see when we were talking about, you know, the Celtic Rangers both in Champions League games, and they did say they would give the option of them to postpone their games if they wanted. First of all, I think people knew Celtic were not going to take up that option anyway, but people did point out, we were playing Shakhtar Donetsk. Could you imagine going to this Ukrainian team from the eastern Ukraine and saying, no, we don't think you can play this game because the Queen died? He'd be like, sorry. Sorry, you were watching the news, you see what we're dealing with, and we're still playing.
Yeah.
So that would have been quite a bizarre scenario.
I'd like this, the conversation, you know, around, oh, we think we should have a minute silence, and the Ukrainian side thinking, oh, that's very nice, actually. And then going, oh, no, not like that. You got the wrong end of the stick.
Did you see what happened with the Celtic game?
Was it the clapping?
Yeah, they tried to get around that by having a minute of applause, and they unveiled a banner saying, if you hate the royal family, clap your hands.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And I also saw the Dundee United supporters. You know, I'm not a big football fan, but when I do go to a football game, it's a United game to cheer them on. And they were singing, inspired by the Irish teams that have been doing it, singing Lizzie's in a Box.
And you're right, that's what they were scared of. You know, it completely punctured this facade that the whole country was in mourning and everybody was heartbroken because they lost this important figure in their life. And it's hard to argue that when you see people being so openly disdainful in the situation.
I was in Belfast, I think it was a week or two ago, and obviously that had made such an impression, because every time I met someone new and I said I was from Dundee, they were like, oh, Dundee, you guys were causing trouble recently. I had to tread carefully.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I imagine that would be quite contentious, like, in that part of the world.
Yeah.
I did see a thing on social media, like, when there was all the speculation that the Queen had passed away, but they hadn't actually announced it. Sinn Féin had emailed all their supporters a reminder to be respectful on social media. And that was that for a lot of people, that was, well, Sinn Féin is telling everybody to be careful what they say. It's definitely coming.
Yeah. And I mean, like, Sinn Féin has offices in Westminster. They don't take their seats, but they have the apparatus there. There's no way they wouldn't have picked up on what was happening.
Yeah. I mean, it was an open secret, but, you know, if in North Korea, you know, the head of state had died, well, I suppose the head of state is dead, but if the leader in North Korea had died and the media didn't tell anybody for hours and hours when everybody knew it happened and didn't do it until the official okay to do it, people would be like lambasting them for being like a propaganda machine. Yeah, it was completely accepted that the BBC were just not announcing it completely. You find well this had happened hours ago and we're still keeping up the pretense that there was just concerns about our health.
I actually didn't think the BBC operation was that, you know, well choreographed and planned as they claimed that it would be, you know, this thing that they've all been preparing for all their lives. I was a little bit underwhelmed. I mean, obviously, they did shove all, they had all this stuff ready to go. But in terms of, like, the presenters that were put on the spot in the live broadcast, they seemed terrified, not quite sure what was going on.
Well, I mean, I can kind of understand why, because, you know, they were just saying the wrong thing and they could get hammered. It was that very, you know...
Imagine poppy. If they were seen to be skipping a queue, for example.
Oh, exactly. A kind of poppy season sort of scrutiny. Like, God forbid you forgot to wear your poppy, or you wore something that was turned out to be under bright lights looking dark brown rather than black. That would be finished.
Yeah, end your career.
Anyway, I think we'll need to wrap it up there because my throat is really struggling. Was I on air when I was talking about the fact that...
I think you shared that.
Just in case I didn't mean people are talking about what's up in your throat.
It's just too suspicious. Deborah's not here. David's been replaced by someone who sounds a bit different. It's actually just me. I've done a coup. I've taken over the podcast. I've got an AI-generated David McClement here.
Yeah, he stepped in as the constitutional monarch to remove you from office. I'll need to work that into your next intro.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Connor.
Pleasure.
I think you're due on again in a few weeks' time.
Yep.
Really looking forward to have you back. Next week, hopefully, Deborah has sorted out our iPad issues and she'll be back with us. I'll be here next week. And I think we have Alan Grogan joining us next week. So,
nice. Give him my best.
Will do. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you can get all our podcasts at leftungag.org. We also produce a North American-based monthly podcast called World Beat with George Collin. You can also catch up with the Talking Saints podcast with Kat and Erin. And if you want us to talk about anything on Hollywood, you can tweet us at _ungagged or hashtag HollywoodUngagged or email us ungagleft@gmail.com and put Hollywood Ungagged subjectly. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us 5 stars and whatever platform you use. Also, just to add to my wee spiel, we now have a Discord community. I noticed, Connor, you joined that today or yesterday. Anyone else that's interested in joining, just contact us through social media and we'll get you added. I think that's all. Again, Connor, thanks for joining us. Everybody, thanks for listening. And we'll catch up with you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me, David, and get well soon.